Hello and welcome to this special series from Great British Brands in association with Changemakers. It's a collection of conversations with outstanding guests where we seek the answer to a very big question: what next? And in the course of answering that, we explore what it takes to be a great British brand and the people and stories behind them. Now, my guest today is a brilliant example of this. He's Archie Hewlett, the CEO and founder of the London footwear brand Duke & Dexter. He launched it in 2014, and Duke & Dexter has since become the brand of choice for the great and the good of global show business, including Ryan Reynolds, Rihanna, Justin Timberlake, Snoop Dogg, and David Beckham, all after Eddie Redmayne sported his own pair when collecting his Oscar for Best Actor in 2015. Designed in London and handmade in Sheffield, this is a story of great British design, innovation, and entrepreneurship, all wrapped up in an ethical ethos. Now, to tell us more, Archie, welcome to Changemakers. Absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Let's start with that Eddie Redmayne moment. I mean, he walked out in the shoes and the rest is history. How'd that happen?
Well, thanks for having me, Michael. It was a funny one. We obviously got going way back to 2015 days, so way before we had any planning, any team. I still use we, but it was very much I back then. And it was really just off chance. We were looking at that time. Obviously, the business was made up almost entirely of loafers as the kind of core. So we were looking at finding ways of getting the shoes out there, getting designs and product out there. And it was as basic as sending Eddie a pair in preparation for the Oscars. And we did it so far in advance that I think actually by the time the Oscars came round, we'd completely forgotten about it and the whole thing. So it was
he just chanced it. You just sent him a box of shoes and said, "Hope you can wear this."
Complete chance. And that was back at the time when my mum was involved and has never let me forget it. So yeah, complete chance.
Well, I'm not surprised. I mean, talk about, what did they say, fortune favors the prepared mind. I mean, it sounds like you had a good mailing list there. I mean, but I guess you mean, you talk about your mum. I mean, you started this business at 19. You are a very young entrepreneur some years later, but you started this business still in your teens. Take us back to the 19-year-old that actually got going and had that all happen.
Sure. I mean, it started the business at 19, but in a very different light and a very different way of looking at things back then, Michael. The brand was far less of a sort of priority, if you like, and it was more about getting into a new world away from recruitment, which I was doing at the time, and looking to do my own thing. But as I say, that the importance of that was that the brand was sort of fell to one side, and the focus was actually more on working from home, which is something of the norm now, and getting out of London and understanding what I wanted to do, having dropped out of university, where I wanted to go with career and so on. But the real driver back then was to do my own thing.
I mean, you say back then, I mean, 2014 is the very near memory. I mean, it's sort of, it's a matter of a couple of thousand days ago. I mean, it's sort of, but I mean, I suppose reflective of the journey of a lot of fast growth entrepreneurs is that you get started quickly and things change very quickly for you. So it started with an idea that you wanted to run your own life. You didn't want to go down the same routes that many others went. I mean, very quickly, you established a brand, though, that was more than just a life passion. It was a business passion, you know, a fast scaling business. In terms of where you learned from and how you actually sort of built up your experience in super fast time, what were the influences? What were the inspirations, would you say?
Yeah, but obviously, again, going back then, I had no direct experience in shoes, which was a complete blessing, because I've always said, you know, in more recent times, as people have asked for advice or even just to bounce ideas of what they're doing, a lot of the time, the stuff you hear about and the new things that people are starting, a lot of the time is very samey. And really, you can almost kind of actually, if you wanted to, and you could say, oh, it sounds pretty similar to X. And there are, you know, many examples of that, certainly across footwear, but brands and D2C, direct to consumer businesses as a whole. And I think the beauty of D&D and how it started was it was a really niche for want of a better word, angle. It was, you know, going down and the velvet slipper route was the real core. Now, I've never worn velvet slippers.
Love velvet slippers. I'm prepared to put it out there for the record. I mean, how did you get onto the velvet slippers as an idea?
I honestly can't remember. As you know, I don't have a clear view of why. The story goes, and I do think it was part of the reasoning was that obviously in recruitment I was going to a lot of events, and I noticed at the events that, you know, it was a very boring shoe array of obviously brogues, but either black or brown, and obviously prior to that, having, you know, been around school life, no one ever cared about your attire or even just your dress sense. You know, almost that the less you cared, the cooler you were, type sense. So it was based off that as an initial founding block, at least I think.
Know, it's your business. Come on, I mean, where did you get the name from? Where did that come from, Deacon Dexter?
It's made up as well. It gets even more basic, that side of things. I put two names on a piece of paper, and I wanted an and or a plus because I thought it sounded more professional.
I mean, a lot of people, you know, who are will say, oh, well, you know, we've been making shoes for 300 years. You know, there is authenticity running through our brand. And here comes Archie with his brand that's been around for a couple of thousand days, and it's ripping out the market. This is not the authentic product. This is somebody who's had a good idea and he's gone to market with it. I mean, I'm presuming you've got a riposte or a rebuttal of that in terms of why today's circumstances really do favor young digital brands that seem to be getting it very, very quickly and going to market increasingly quickly too.
Yeah, definitely. I think the way in which stories are told, the way in which, you know, heritage plays a part, or tradition and so on. Don't get me wrong, there's massive value in it. And the heritage, you know, the value in it comes more from the learnings and the constant improvements that a brand can make. But I also just think, you know, obviously with all the new tools and social media and so on, you can tell such effective stories through these platforms, and you can tell such powerful and meaning stories that connect with people, and that's what we've really tried to do.
I think something in addition, though, is you've made purpose a big part of your brand, haven't you, in terms of sustainability, how you source materials, how you avoid wastage. And so that feels like such a big issue for the conscious consumer, consumers that want to be defined by their choices. Explain a little bit more about how you are driving that more purposeful style into the business.
Yeah, sure. I think it's a good question, Michael. I think the purpose side of things is trying to build a connection and a meaning with the customer, and that is, it can sound so airy and so naff, but there is genuine meaning behind it. And it's to say that, you know, the way we put it into simple terms is, when a customer has a pair of D&Ds on, if they get asked where they're from, or I like those shoes, can that customer tell a story beyond just saying, oh, that, you know, they're from Duke and Dexter, or, oh yeah, I bought them because they're white, or they're, you know, black or brown, whatever. It's trying to give them a reasoning to say, oh, you know, I bought them from Duke and Dexter and they did this style in partnership with X, or, oh, they, you know, only released a certain number and the story behind it is Y. And by doing so, you give so much more reasoning for a customer to choose to buy, and a customer choose to become a part of that story and that identity. And I think that's what gets lost a lot, you know, a lot of the time. I think nowadays, obviously, we're seeing so many purpose-driven brands in terms of how they started. But it, you know, that then becomes almost one-dimensional for a lot of them in terms of.
But is that a reason that, I guess, brings people to you, or is that what you talk to them about in terms of the buying process?
I'm a strong believer in the lighthouse effect. And I think if you go out and you know, brands are almost like a movement, almost nowadays, given obviously political views and so on that brands almost seem to need to have, they're almost like people now and they have opinions. And I think if you go out with a clear set of those opinions and values that
right.
you hold.
So the lighthouse is what you shine a light on, is it?
Exactly. And people will come to you in the benefits of social, and how close a community, a global community you can have. If you go out with a clear message, a clear standing, a clear reason for people to come to you, they will find you.
Does that speak to an age group and a demographic, or is that just a universal truth now? I mean, I'm just saying, in terms of, you know, the buyers of your shoes, I mean, are they a younger demographic which are more in tune, more digitally native, more kind of into purpose, or do you think that this is now just the future of retail?
I think it's definitely, you know, it's definitely stemmed from and leans from a younger generation, but I think it's becoming a more widely adopted view for sure. I think the way in which people are thinking about what they're buying, why they're buying it, of course there's a massive angle for, and rightly so, for so many brands in fashion, given the industry and the impact it's having on the environment. There's a massive sustainability part, but it's more than that now, Michael. It's looking at really trying to build just a genuine purpose for a customer. And because of, you know, I think that's also just been purely built from the complexity and the number of brands that are now, you know, in the market.
I mean, it strikes me that you are a very disruptive character. I mean, in terms of you didn't go down the straightforward route on life choices that you might well have been expected to do. You created a business at a very young age. You've gone in to disrupt a very well-established part of the of the retail space. I know also that one of your great British brands that you've told us to look at is BrewDog, Business for Punks. The idea that actually you can tear up the rule book and you can create your own way. I mean, I suppose, am I interviewing the arch disruptor here?
As all of the D&D team will know, I'm not a massive fan of the word disruption because I think it's overused and overplayed. But
give us your own word then.
We internally define it as subversive.
Subversive, mix it up.
But sophisticated as well. So it's a bit of a tongue twister, but we, you know, refer to that almost core value of the business as being subversive sophistication, which is to say, do things differently, you know, have an ante, have a reason to go against, you know, not a brand, but have a reason to stand for something different, but do it in a classy and respectful manner, I think is the best way that we describe it internally.
Okay. Because I'm loving this idea. I want to just go into subversive sophistication. I can see that you like your alliteration. I mean, Duke and Dexter, subversive sophistication. In terms of, bring that to life in terms of what does that mean in life? I mean, to be a subversive sophisticat. I mean, I'm presuming you see these as the Duke and Dexter shoe wearers.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's people that are in whatever walk of life are trying to go against the grain, trying to do things differently, but it doesn't then come with a brashness. It's not arrogance, crucially. You know, we obviously, as you'll know, all our shoes are handmade in England. There's a massive quality element. And I think that quality element in terms of the almost literal sense of the product is then also translated into the lifestyle of D&D. And I think that's exactly what it is. It's someone who's, our customer is that person who wants to go against the grain, but they also want to, you know, live a life with purpose and not just become brash.
I'm a kind of velvet slipper guy. I love wearing them, but I wouldn't describe myself as a subversive. I mean, what gives you the subversive angle to that?
We've come a long way from just velvet slippers, Michael, as I'm sure you'll know, and as I'm sure you'll be finding out after the call. You know, there's a style element to it, of course, right? We're looking at the way in which we design and the way we build out styles.
I've seen the designs. I've seen how you add stuff to them. Yeah,
but also, you know, it's the way in which we tell stories as well. We want to excite. We want to inspire. And we also, you know, we want to cause a sense of not concern, but certainly, and I'm trying to avoid the word disruption, but certainly.
You can use it. It doesn't offend me. It only offends you.
You know, we want to get people thinking, get people reacting, good or bad. And I think that's super important. I think you have to, as a brand, you know, especially if you're coming into a market, you've got to come with a point of difference.
I was reading that a big part of the journey for you was the opening of your flagship store, your first big London store in 2016. Just explain that feeling of opening the front door for the first time, seeing the product laid out, that kind of like as a retailer and as an entrepreneur, love to get the sense of the moment from your perspective.
Yeah, I think it's so tangible is the simple way of putting it. You go from building an online brand where your store, your front of house is your website, and it's also digitally led. And as soon as then you use a third party for your distribution, you barely even see the bulk of the shoes. Of course, samples are coming and going, but it becomes so digital. And obviously, as a brand, that started purely online, it's so digitally orientated. Mm. So the moment we opened the first store in Covent Garden, that all changed, and you're able to add in the quirks that we did, and it really brought a sense of the brand to life. We did such basic things that were probably even more basic now than they are back then, but simple things like free coffee and a sofa area and a TV on the wall that was playing films or movies or Wimbledon if it was that time of year, and it was trying to be this just store that had a character to it.
Character, let's bring that story up to date, because here we are living through coronavirus lockdowns, of which there'll be moments where your stores have got to shut and moments when they can open again. But I presume that the digital heritage is hugely important to the onward success of the business. How has that experience worked in terms of the business during the period, I guess?
Yeah, I don't think anyone's enjoyed the challenges from battling out if you've got retail presence and online. Of course, the physical retail has been hurt massively. We're almost, and I say this very carefully, but we're almost lucky in the sense that Covent Garden is so tourist driven, so it's kind of completely lost its customer base.
But what happened? I mean, sorry to bring everything back to velvet slippers, but I'm presuming that you're doing quite well with those. If everybody sat at home working from home, in terms of like the things that people are buying, I mean, are people still buying in the same way? Are they buying other things? How's experience for the business been in terms of trading?
Trading online has obviously improved relative to the other channels. It's obviously been a tough year. I think the biggest challenge, if you're looking at sales figures and so on, is what you compare to, because typically, obviously, you'd compare to last month or last year. And the way in which all businesses have had to adapt has meant that, of course, a lot of them, like us, have changed our collections. And we went into, again, to your point on velvet slippers, Michael, we went back to the loafer core and thought, right, this at core as a loafer is such an easy everyday shoe to slip on and off. So that's what we did. We went back down that route. We looked at not velvet slippers, I'm afraid to say, but we looked at
I haven't got shares in them, don't worry.
We looked at what we call the Scott loafer, which is a non-marking sole that can be worn indoors and outdoors. And I think that's the biggest thing that a lot of brands have done across the lockdown COVID 2020 era is people have tried to become very sort of product specific in terms of, okay, you're stuck at home, therefore you need this. And that's obviously been a big change and a big shift, and we've seen that across all brands, both in apparel, in obviously gym wear, which has flown. People have come a lot more just almost purpose driven in what they're buying.
Okay, so they want to know what goes into it. They want to know the ethics of it. But now let's look about the look in terms of the what comes next, because it strikes me that times are defined by the clothes that people choose to wear quite often, in terms of it becomes very identifiable, because you can tell decades by the styles and the fashions. And I suppose great events also have an influence on the way that people may choose to approach clothes in the future. And when you look at things like shoes, the thing that I'm just wondering is that when you look to what comes next when we come out of the coronavirus in terms of the choices. Obviously, your bet is on the more mindful consumer wanting to have a connection. But in terms of the actual shoes they're going to choose, what's going to be the, what are the styles that you think are going to be coming out of this when we go back? I mean, are we going to ever go back to wearing the sort of things we wore before we went into coronavirus, for example?
I think the one thing that we're certainly hedging our bets on is that people will want to dress up again, and they'll want to have a bit of flair and a bit of style. I think, you know, we've all lived, apart from you, I think, Michael, looking very smart today, but we have all lived in you know, trackies and T-shirts and so on. And so we've spent this year very much, you know, dressing down.
I mean, for the listeners' benefit, I'm not doing this interview in a dinner jacket. I mean, I'm only wearing a cardigan. I mean, it's
and I think that will be the big. I'm hoping that will be the big.
So people are going to want to have an exuberant response to this. Express themselves.
Exactly that. They'll want to express themselves. They'll want to, you know, add that bit of extra flair and style that perhaps they hadn't worn in the past and so on. And I think it's a very elaborate way of talking about it across the whole population. But I just think as a whole, for whatever your, you know, your norm is and your basic, I think people will, on the whole, just want to, you know, look to wear that, you know, extra piece or extra bit of style, because it's been such a dull year in that sense.
I mean, it strikes me that, you know, you often say, you often hear the phrase, oh, they were born to do this. It strikes me you love what you do. You've got a real passion for it, that you were born to be an entrepreneur. I mean, is that how you see it? There seems to be the entrepreneur in you comes across so strongly in the interview. I mean, do you love it as much as you come across?
I definitely love it, and I think you have to love it. And it's such a cliche; it's overused and so on. But it is an extremely intense. It's very lonely at times. It's incredibly difficult at almost the best of times. So you've got to love it, because you have to be this eternal optimist to deal with a lot of that.
Yeah, I mean, and your tip for life: nothing is achieved without hard work, relentless hard work. I mean, some people could hear that and go, oh, that sounds awful. I mean, but for you, that's a plus, isn't it?
Definitely. And I think it's something that I wholly stand by. Again, it's certainly not the first person to say it. And it probably is one of those things people go, yeah, obviously. But it's not that obvious, because a lot of people love to start stuff. And it doesn't have to even be, you know, a brand or even a business that they're starting. But, you know, everything that comes good comes with hard work. And the hard work is done in different ways. It doesn't mean sitting at a computer, you know, 14-hour days. It's in lots of different forms. But I'm a massive believer in that. I just think anything good achieved has to come with a lot of hard work and diligence.
Do you think some of that is because of the stage of life that you're in? Because, I mean, you're 27 now, I think, where I'm interviewing at. And, you know, I suppose, is this part of your innate character, or do you think it's part of the stage of life that you're in?
No, I think it's definitely part of my character. And I think I realised that pretty quickly into the D&D journey. You know, not always for the best of reasons in terms of the efficiencies of doing stuff, but I can remember from a very early stage, you know, friends wanting to go out, have a drink or so on, and being perfectly happy, just cracking on with work and what needed to be done. And I think that's just been inherently born in. And it has to come hand in hand with the love of what you're doing. I don't just love working hard for something I don't enjoy, quite the opposite. But
you mentioned the Duke and Dexter journeys. So obviously great for a shoe company to have a journey. You know, we're going to walk the line. I mean, so in terms of actually where you're going to walk to next with the brand, and in terms of the business, in terms of thinking about the what's next for Duke and Dexter, what does come next?
The biggest, our core of what we revolve around is partnerships and collaborations, again, a massively overused word, but we love, you know, that's what the business has always done, from very small scale, not even collaborations, just, you know, almost mini endorsements, if you like, with Eddie Redmayne, through to obviously Snoop Dogg, Jensen Button and so on. That for us is the nuts and bolts of what we love doing, because I think it adds so much excitement. It tells such interesting stories, and it makes certainly in our sphere of the shoe world, you know, so much more exciting than what a lot of brands are doing. So that's really what next year we're getting excited by. There are some really exciting partnerships coming up, certainly our biggest to date, and
you want to share with us biggest partnership to date? Is that under wraps, or can you share that?
It's under wraps.
Come on, it's just you and I speaking. It's fine.
I'll tell you afterwards.
Oh, well, okay, fine. Well, anyway, listen, Archie, thank you very much for joining us on this absolutely excellent edition, I hope, of Great Changemakers X with Great British Brands. I've been a real real joy interviewing you and hearing the story of this sort of outstanding young brand, Duke & Dexter, and how it is, dare I say it, disrupting the shoe industry. He's wincing on screen as I'm saying that. But that's it for this edition. It's been a story, I think, of the guts to go for it. I mean, I think that's quintessentially what British entrepreneurship is often about. People that have got an idea, who then create a globally sought after brand that continues to grow today. And for more from entrepreneurs with an eye on those future trends, do join me next time for Changemakers with Great British Brands.